Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
Dan Goldman became a familiar figure to Americans a year ago when he was the senior advisor and director of investigations for the House Intelligence Committee, did most of the questioning of witnesses in the probe leading up to the first impeachment of Donald Trump. He also is a veteran prosecutor who worked in the Southern District of New York and a well-known legal commentator. And I thought it would be great to sit down with him now to talk about what's going on and also to talk about his very interesting and unique journey. Here's that conversation. Dan Goldman, it's really great to see you, particularly at this moment. You've got a rich story, and I want to explore that. But first, I want to tap your expertise. So welcome. Good to see you.
Thanks so much for having me, David. It's great to be here.
Yeah, we were joking before we started rolling about it's sort of a not funny joke about the fact that impeachment has now become an annual event. You were involved in the last one. I'm wondering, as you observe this one, what your sense is of how it's a much different kind of trial than the one that you were involved in, because you're sitting in a room full of witnesses.
There are a number of reasons it's different, but that is certainly a critical one. And not just the witnesses in the Senate, but so many Americans witnessed these events, who are watching them again. Unlike the Ukraine matter, where, it was more of a typical investigation where you don't have live footage of everything that transpired, this one you do. And the senators, I think, certainly felt like they were brought back to that day. But what was interesting, and I think so powerful, about the presentation of the narrative of what occurred on January 6th is so many of the senators had no idea about so much of what was shown. Everyone had their own individual experience, but no one understood what was happening across the Capitol or outside or downstairs or upstairs. They just lived it themselves. And I thought what was really powerful is, and the House managers did an excellent job, and some of my former colleagues putting this together, is that it really painted the fullest picture we've seen yet about what exactly happened on that day and how close so many of these senators and other officials were to being in the line of fire.
I'm not a lawyer. I defy my mother and I never did become a lawyer, but I don't think it took a lawyer to see that was a very tight case yesterday. Not just the vivid depiction of events, as you said, but the build up to it, the case of what Trump did for months and months and months leading up to it, the case about what he did to actually bring people to Washington on that day, and to before he ever spoke, creating a sense of premeditation for what happened, and then the case about what he didn't do once the insurrection was going on, and his failure to act, which should be infuriating to senators, but also really goes to the goes to the essence of whether he lived up to his oath.
And you could absolutely have charged an entire separate impeachable offense based on his dereliction of duty after the fact that day. But it goes right to the heart of what his state of mind was and why we do know that this was what he expected and what he wanted. But what I really thought was effective is, you know, when you sit and watch, whether it was that 13-minute video on day one or the presentations of Stacey Plaskett and Eric Swalwell yesterday going through the actual riot, Donald Trump, of course, is not a part of that aspect of the story. What occurred at the Capitol did not include Donald Trump. He was, notwithstanding the fact that he told them he was going to go there, he wasn't there. But what they did so well in the lead up to that section of the presentation was to build layer upon layer of how integrally involved Donald Trump was in the build up to the events of January 6th. And yes, of course, you know, he incited them that day in the speech, but it was so much more than that. And what I thought it was a really, really well done presentation starting back in May and June of how he was planting the seed for the big lie that this was that the only way he was going to lose was if the election was rigged. And then how he celebrated on Twitter, I love Texas, retweeting the video of some Trump supporters trying to drive a Biden-Harris bus off of the road. That is a specific endorsement of violent behavior by the president himself. And then shortly after the election, when he used a lot of the same rhetoric that he used on January 6th, and what ensued was were many of his supporters going to various state houses and election counting centers where they were, you know, carrying weapons and threatening violence and encouraging to stop the count, to the Million MAGA March on December 12th, where there was actual violence that occurred. And not only did he not, did he not speak about the violence directly, and did he not disavow it, and did he not, you know, try to stamp down the violence that day, but he encouraged it. And then those same people who were involved in January 6th, and you know, his rhetoric, of course, was inflammatory. And even though he didn't say, go to the Capitol and storm the Capitol, what he said was the sort of same rhetoric that he had used that they to incite violence among his supporters. And his supporters, I thought this was so effective as well, his supporters understood him to mean that they should go and literally try to physically stop the certification of the votes. And so it was really a well done setup that once we got to the actual events of January 6th, when Stacey Plaskett called it Trump's mob, we really understood that it was Trump's mob.
Yeah, you know, as you speak admiringly of the case, it strikes me that storytelling is so much a part of these kinds of proceedings and really bringing the narrative to life about what happened. And they did that. But you also said, even though he didn't say storm the Capitol, that's what they interpreted the message that way. That's precisely what Republican senators who have already indicated that they're not under any circumstance going to vote for his conviction will hang their hat on that. And the fact that at the end he said, you know, march peacefully down to the Capitol. But it underscores something that you uniquely must appreciate. You sat in that chamber during the impeachment trial a year ago. And, you know, you're used to a certain set of rules and parameters. You're used to impartial jurors the rules of litigation. This is a political exercise. At the end of the day, we treat it like it is a prosecution. It is not a prosecution in the sense that senators aren't bound by the same rules. They do take an oath of impartiality that they all could probably be impeached for violating that oath. But how weird is it to sit there knowing that you can put on the greatest case in the world, the greatest case in history, and you're probably going to lose?
It was a very unusual experience in that regard last time around. I said afterwards that I felt like there were almost two parallel trials going on. There was the actual evidence and the actual case that we were presenting, and then there was sort of the political reaction and the political fallout and the political influence. The biggest lesson I learned from the last Senate trial is it is a misnomer to call it a trial, and it bears so little resemblance to what actually happens in a courtroom. And frankly, it starts on a different path because there really is no judge. Chief Justice Roberts presided over the last one because Donald Trump was the president at the time, but he didn't make a single substantive ruling.
Yeah.
Every rule, every decision is made by the Senate itself. So you don't have anyone enforcing anything. And the best example of why that would be so valuable in this trial is the Senate has the power under the Constitution, the sole power to try impeachments. So whatever rules the Senate makes, whatever resolutions that they pass, that is the end of the story in terms of setting the parameters for the trial. So there was a motion to dismiss on Tuesday to dismiss the article because this trial is taking place after Donald Trump his term has expired. And the Senate voted to deny that motion 56-44 and to rule that it is constitutional to go forward with this trial. In a courtroom, if you had a legal ruling, that would be the end of it. You maybe appeal it at the end, but you go forward and the lawyers could not argue to the jury that this is unconstitutional law, and the jury could not rely on that legal explanation in making their decision. So if you were to follow that kind of exercise here, the senators should not be able to rely on this unconstitutional argument that they made, that because it's after his term has expired, he can't be tried. They should not be able to rely on that for the factual determination on the merits as to whether or not Donald Trump violated his oath of office by inciting this insurrection. But that's what we're going to see. And yes, that is, a shame. I think it is a dereliction of the senator's duty to both follow their own rules and their own laws and to take the oath of office to be an impartial juror, so to speak, in this case.
On this point of he didn't tell them to go down there and do what they did, and he was shocked and surprised like everybody else. And would the evidence that was presented yesterday be compelling in a court of law, even without his explicit instruction to the crowd to go down and storm the Capitol?
So I prosecuted the mafia in the Southern District of New York.
We'll talk about that, yeah.
And I prosecuted a mob boss for murder and racketeering, among other crimes. And
sounds dangerous, by the way, but go ahead.
Well, it's a whole other story. I actually felt more concerned for my safety doing the impeachment than I did prosecuting mob bosses. But it's a very similar dynamic, which is that a mob boss does not say to his soldiers, please go kill this person. The mob boss says, hey, I need you to take care of this. And as Michael Cohen, I think, very persuasively explained when he testified before Congress, Donald Trump speaks like a mob boss. He talks to people in a way where there is plausible deniability, but everyone understands what he means. And if you need an example of that, look at the Proud Boys. When Donald Trump said when he was asked if he would denounce the Proud Boys in that debate on September 29th, and he said, stand back and stand by. They made t-shirts.
Yeah.
The Proud Boys did, based on that expression. Now, that in and of itself does not say go be violent in support of me, but the message was taken and it was very clear. And so what is an advantage that the managers have in this case that a prosecutor would not have in a courtroom is it is hard. I mean, in some way, it is harder to get in evidence in a courtroom as to how people interpreted what somebody said. Here, though, it's perfectly permissible to play all these videos of Trump supporters saying that they were there at the Capitol at the direction of Donald Trump, that they were doing what Donald Trump wanted. So that defense kind of falls by the wayside when the people who he's speaking to understood him to mean go commit violence. So the argument then has to be they misunderstood what he said, but that's where all of that evidence in the lead up, where he's supporting violence, where he's on notice. Right after the election, when he makes some of the same, you know, they're stealing this from us, yeah. They're stealing this election, we can't let that happen. And he sees people going out with, you know, violent intentions and weapons in reaction to him. He knows, he's on notice as to what reaction his supporters will have to the same rhetoric.
You know, his lawyers, and I should ask you what you thought of their presentation, but his lawyer, Bruce Castor, said, look, if he is guilty of instigating insurrection and a riot, he's a private citizen now. He should be indicted. You should arrest him. I presume he said that assuming that there wasn't going to be enough evidence in a court of law to actually do that. Is that fair? Or was he just stumbling along there?
Well, I think he was stumbling along. I think the worst decision that they made was to switch up what their plan was. It's very difficult. If you have a plan going in as a lawyer and you make a last minute change that you're not prepared for, that usually does not work out well. But look, it's sort of a quintessential legal theory, which is just live to fight another day. Right. The issue they're facing right now is impeachment. If they can say, if they can kick this to a criminal process or a civil litigation proceeding in a court somewhere else, if they can just get rid of this for any reason whatsoever, that's what they want to do. They'll live to fight another day. If he gets investigated and charged in court, then they'll say, oh, well, they should have impeached him, not charged yeah. him, you know, in court. I mean, it's sort of a euphemistic, you know, phrase or kind of a strategy that so many attorneys use. But, you know, look, there should be a fuller accounting of what occurred. I mean, the one thing that we don't have a lot of in this impeachment that you would want in any kind of a criminal prosecution is a better sense of you know, what Trump knew, when he knew it, what intelligence did he receive, what did he say or do in regard to the National Guard, both before and after, what comments did he make as he was watching it. I mean, we know we had the newspaper article that he was delighted as he was watching it and he wasn't responsive, but there's a lot more that you would want to get out of that. I don't think you don't need that for impeachment. Remember, impeachment is a far lesser
right.
issue than a criminal proceeding, because we're not talking about him going to jail.
You're talking about forfeiture of office or disqualification from office.
Yeah. Okay. So what? So so you know, you have to go be a businessman. You can't be a politician anymore. I mean, it's not the end of the world. It's not going to jail.
Right.
So, you know, let's remember that the standard is so much lower for impeachment because it's simply, are you up to serving the people of this country in an office of honor and trust and you know, power? And it's you know, if you're not, it's not the end of the world.
It's hard to read the presidential oath of office and see the fact pattern that we saw yesterday and say, yeah, I think he fulfilled his duties. It's very hard to do that. One last question relative to this. The prosecutor in Fulton County has opened up an investigation about Trump's efforts to overturn the results there, his call to Secretary Raffensperger, to investigators there, to others, the governor, seeking to overturn the result. Based on what you know, and you probably listened to the whole phone call as I've listened to the whole phone call he made, do you think he has exposure there?
I think the law, as you read it in Georgia, the Georgia state law, seems like it very well could apply to this situation. What I would be curious about, and this is where an investigation would be important, is we have that call, but what we understand, you know, we understand that the U.S. attorney in Atlanta abruptly resigned under the reports under some pressure. What kind of conversations did Trump or surrogates, agents of Trump, have with that U.S. attorney? What other conversations did they have with Brian Kemp, the governor? You would want to fill in a broader picture than mm-hmm. that simple recording. And, you know, this is just sort of prosecution 101 and defense 101. You'll remember in the Ukraine matter, the Trump's defense wanted to narrow the issue to the text of that July 25th call. And they parsed it very closely and tried to explain it. Of course, we wanted to broaden it, and we did broaden it to show that this was a months-long scheme, and that was a critical, critical piece of evidence, but it was not the whole story. Similarly here, January 6th speech and Trump is not at all the whole story, even though what I expect to hear from the defense is to focus exclusively on that speech. And it's similar with the Raffensperger call. That's what we know, and that's what we're focused on. And boy, to have a recording like that is you know, evidentiary gold.
Yes.
You know, when you're trying to prosecute this. But it makes all of the other witness statements so much more realistic, and it corroborates them if they are going to be a similar of nature. So that's why it's, I mean, not only you have his own words, but it also, you can't refute a recording. So when you have witness statements that are sort of similar to what you hear Donald Trump doing in that, it makes it a lot easier to charge. But I think you need to paint the fuller picture in Georgia. But based on the reading of the law, it absolutely could apply in this
situation. Well, she's obviously casting a very large net too, and doing the things that you suggest.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now, back to the show.
Let me turn to you and your own journey. And if we can just go back, first of all, a half a dozen generations or so. I've said this before to others. There are people who come on this podcast who are stories of, you know, stories of people who came from the wrong side of the tracks and lifted themselves up. You came decidedly from the right side of the tracks. Tell me about the history of your family going back to, I guess, your great, great, great grandfather or something, Levi Strauss.
Yeah, no, it's you are right. I am the descendant of the true American dream in many respects, and my great, great, great uncle was Levi Strauss, who obviously went out to San Francisco in the gold rush and started making some jeans for the miners. And it turned into
pretty good gig, you know,
an iconic US brand. Exactly. And so the company has mostly run by, you know, my family members over during the 20th century. It's now public and it's now not run by my family. But I grew up, you know, with the knowledge that I was incredibly lucky to be, a descendant of an iconic brand in the United States and a well-off family. And philanthropy and giving back.
With a very, very long and deep history of philanthropy as well. Levi Strauss himself was, he was an immigrant, a Jew from Bavaria, and helped establish the kind of reformed Jewish community in San Francisco. And then, you know, your family has been very deeply, deeply involved in a lot of causes, lifting up people, the environment, and so on. So I think that part of the story needs to be told as well.
Well, I appreciate it. And it is true. And it's something that I grew up just a part of the fabric of sort of my life and my existence is that, you know, we were very lucky, as you say, to be on the right side of the tracks. And I have lived my life in recognition of that and wanting very much to give back. It's both in terms of, you know, financial philanthropy, but time. And for my personal professional goals, public service. And so that has been the sort of the through line in everything that I've tried to do and want to do in my life is to try to give back to a country that has given so much to my family. And so that's sort of how I ended up on this track.
You also had an example in your dad who was a federal prosecutor. I want to ask you a little bit about how that influenced your ultimate decision, you think. But you also, and I say this as someone who lost my dad at a very young age, but you lost him at a very young age. He was 43, I guess. You were 13. Tell me about that and how that impacted on you.
Yeah, that was, you know, that was the seminal sort of event in my life, and I like to, you know, I ended up coming around to it by or accepting it as to say, you know, I had a lot of luck and benefits, but I also had to deal, as you did, David, with some real adversity and losing my father to a brain tumor when I was 13 years old. It happened very quickly, and he passed away very quickly. And you know, I was the oldest of three children, at 13 years old. My brother was 10 and my sister was 7. And, you know, we had to sort of piece it together. And, my dad has been such a motivating factor in my life, perhaps even more so than if he were alive. In many respects, I was kind of sort of chasing his ghost, and, you know, I followed him to college. I did journalism initially in large part because he did journalism. And then ultimately I decided to become a lawyer. And then he was a federal prosecutor in Washington, D.C., where I grew up. And I ended up pursuing that path. There was a degree to which I was trying to connect with him in following his sort of life's path. And I, you know, I didn't, after I left the U.S. Attorney's Office myself and my time as a federal prosecutor, I certainly, you know, would not have expected that I'd be sitting here talking to you or had done impeachment. And it is, I think often about, how much I wish I could share the experiences I've had with him.
Yeah, I'm sure. You know, when I lost my dad, the thing that I was 19 and I was already in college, and I was kind of estranged from my mom. And it was like at that moment, my childhood was over and my my adulthood began. You were the oldest. Did you feel responsibility as the oldest child to sort of look after your younger siblings and provide something? I mean, did it change you in some way?
Absolutely, and somewhat instantaneously. You know, my mother did an amazing job of raising us, notwithstanding her own heartbreak. But yeah, I made a lot more of an effort to play catch with my brother and to go to my sister's piano recitals and to try to fill in with some of the presence that, you know, my father would have had. But I think that's a good analogy. And, you know, is that you sort of feel a little bit like your childhood's over and you need to grow up a little bit quicker.
When you went off to college, you went to Yale. You say you were interested in journalism, and I know you did some journalism. Was it just that your dad had done it? What was it about journalism that attracted you, and what ultimately caused you to go back to law school?
My father had been a writer for the Yale Daily News when he was in college, and I knew that. I actually was involved with the high school newspaper, and then I got to college and started writing for the Yale Daily News. I was a sports writer, and I used to like to, you know, say, as many sports writers are, that I wasn't good enough to play the sports, so at least I'd write about them. And ultimately,
I should interrupt you and tell you that yesterday when I was reviewing my notes for this, I called a friend of mine, Theo Epstein, who recently resigned after 10 splendid years as the president of the Chicago, or 9 as the president of Chicago Cubs, and you know him well, Hall of Fame candidate in the future. Yep. For what he's done. He was a few years ahead of you as a sports writer on the Yale Daily News, and I called him to ask if he said you were, he wished he had been there with you, he said, because he would have loved to know you, but he was a few years ahead of you, he said.
Yeah, Theo is probably the Yale Daily News. Well, there are some great alums. I won't say that he's the finest alum of the Yale Daily News. But yes, I followed in Theo's footsteps as the sports editor of the Yale Daily News. I think he was 3 years ahead of me. And then after that, I thought I would give it a shot. I felt like there was, there's something about journalism and, you know, both of us have now, after different careers, spent a little bit of time in the media world. And I do feel like there's some aspect, the importance of journalism, and particularly, you know, in this Trump era is heightened so much because there is a real need to provide accurate information, detailed information. And I think the media and journalism is such a lifeblood of our democracy that I felt like there was a lot I had an interest in sports and there was a lot to gain from it. And then after college, I actually went to work for NBC Olympics as an Olympics researcher for the 2000 Olympics, which was a pretty amazing job. I traveled around the world basically interviewing athletes, coaches, journalists for the Olympic sports and felt like, all right, maybe there's a career in television to some degree. But ultimately, I was drawn back to sort of the intellectual rigor of the law and feeling like there were more options out there for me as someone who was interested in civil rights work, in legal equal rights. I wrote my senior thesis on the Jewish involvement in the civil rights movement in the South. So there was always this nagging thing, my father, my family, a bunch of lawyers. So I thought I'd try law school.
By the way, in that you were a predecessor of yours in that Olympic job was Jeff Zucker, who who went on to other things as well. Now, president of CNN, you clerked for a couple of judges. One of them was Charles Breyer, who is the brother of Justice Breyer. Another, Robert Sack. One of the things that interested me is both of them had experience around Watergate. I think Judge, I forget which is which, but I think Judge Breyer was at the DOJ working on the Watergate stuff, Watergate investigation, shouldn't call it stuff. And Judge Sack, who is an appellate court judge you clerked for, was a counsel to the Senate Watergate Committee. Did you go back when you were doing your work and talk to either of them about their experiences from that time? And did they talk to you at that time about having had those experiences?
Yeah, while I was clerking, I did learn about it. In fact, it was really Judge Breyer who turned me on to the idea of becoming, you know, of really pursuing actively a prosecutor. I knew my father had done it, but I had that interest in doing civil rights work. And when I clerked for him, he had been an assistant district attorney after his Watergate experience in San Francisco and then became a criminal defense lawyer. And he just felt like the experience that you got as a line prosecutor was the best training ground that you could get in the law. It was doing important good work, but it was also just really learning how to be a lawyer. So he strongly encouraged me. But it's kind of an ironic twist that they both were involved in the Watergate issue. I mean, so many of the sort of venerable lawyers came out of, you know, some aspect of the Watergate. Another Chicagoan of yours, Jill Winebanks.
Yes.
Was, you know, the very involved in that. And you know, there are so many similarities, but there are a lot. The differences are pretty significant between the Ukraine matter and Watergate. There were so many different aspects of Watergate, right? There was the criminal prosecution and the criminal investigation. There was the House investigation. There was the Senate. It really was the Senate Watergate Committee primarily. That is actually probably the closest analogy to what we did as part of Ukraine, the Ukraine issue in the House Intelligence Committee. But Judge Breyer and Judge Sack were and are wonderful mentors of mine. And I think any law student who has an opportunity to clerk for a judge should jump at it, because you really get a great perspective, not only from your judge, but just of the legal system.
You went to the Southern District of New York, which has a kind of storied history. Did you seek out that assignment? Did you want to go there?
Yes, very much. I only applied to the, I first applied to the Southern District and ended up getting the job. So I didn't end up applying to the Eastern District, which is also a great office in Brooklyn. I it was an unconventional path to the Southern District. Typically, people have a little bit more experience at a law firm doing white collar work, and then they apply into the office. I went straight in from a clerkship, which was atypical, but the office. I didn't even realize it when I was applying. I knew its reputation. I knew that it had such robust units that prosecuted terrorism and corruption and securities and organized crime, among others, that it was it provided so many different opportunities to explore my interests. The reputation, I think, that really jumped out at me that I appreciated was a reputation for independence. And it's been put to the test over the past few years. I think it's held up quite well. But that is, you know, that was always something that I was drawn to. You know, the idea of doing the right thing for the right reasons was so important.
Without fear or favor. Preet Bharara was your boss there for much of that time. So how did you carve out this specialty of yours, which is going after, you know, the Russian mafia and ultimately the homegrown mafia? How did you gravitate to that? Seems like kind of a gritty pursuit for a Sidwell Friends lifer from Washington, D.C.
I loved it. I loved the sort of the thrill of going after organized criminals, organized crime syndicates. And part of the reason is because these were people who were professional criminals. They had made a decision to dedicate themselves to a life of crime. And I felt like those were the most righteous prosecutions. These were not crimes of opportunity, where someone got some inside information, for example, and had to make a decision as to whether or not they were going to capitalize on it, even though, in a one-off opportunity, one-off chance. I mean, these were really bad people, and not all of them were violent. And you don't have to be, violent criminal to be a bad person. These are people who deserve to be prosecuted, deserve to be put away in jail. And it was exciting. I mean, some of the stories, investigations I had were as close to the real life Sopranos as you could imagine. I did a case with another one of your CNN colleagues, Ellie Honig.
Yes.
Where we dug up the FBI dug up a buried body that had been someone who had been murdered and put in a hole in the backwoods of Massachusetts in 2003. And 8 years later, the FBI dug it up. I mean, there were some crazy stories. And so it was fun. It was exciting. It's kind of like, this is a real prosecutor's case.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now, back to the show. Let me ask you a question. Did the name Donald Trump come up at all in your wanderings around at that time? Because it's been, reported many, many times that he had a interesting relationship with organized crime figures in New York, maybe for business reasons, and also with Russian actors. Was that something that, and I don't know what you can say, but I want you to say as much as you can say.
Well, I couldn't say if it did, but I think I can say that it didn't. So,
okay, fair enough.
No, I never came across Donald Trump in any of my work. So it's, I think his a lot of the sort of reported mafia connections were back in the 90s, and they're, I don't know that there's. I'm not sure that all of the details about his Russian connections. That was, frankly, a large part of what I was trying to lead an investigation to find out in the House Intelligence Committee. That's principally why I went down to work for Adam Schiff on that committee, is that he wanted to run a financial investigation to determine whether there were any conflicts of interest that would compromise Donald Trump as president of the United States. And there was a lot of smoke, for obvious reasons, around Russia. Donald Trump's behavior towards Vladimir Putin was such an outlier as to how he behaved towards just about everybody else. It just defied any kind of understanding or logic. So we wanted to look into that to see if there was some explanation for it. But because of Donald Trump's litigious nature, ultimately we didn't get a lot of the materials that we needed to do that.
Do you think some of these loose ends are still out there? And do you think that he has vulnerabilities?
Look, there are a lot of investigations. I said this in 2018. I think he committed campaign finance fraud. I think whether someone does something and whether it can be proved beyond a reasonable doubt based on admissible evidence are two very different questions.
How about these state and local probes that are going on?
Yeah, and will be interesting to see, what comes from that. I don't know what's in, some of the stuff that Michael Cohen talked about in his congressional testimony, related to
inflating and deflating the value of
exactly.
his for different purposes.
Just from a prosecutor's perspective, when you're trying to figure out a proper valuation for something, that's a very difficult thing to have an objective measure of. But when you have the same person valuing the same thing differently, there's an internal inconsistency where only one of them can be right. So, you know, from a prosecutor's perspective, that's a lot easier to charge than if you had to do some sort of independent objective measure of the valuation of something. So that is certainly something that, you know, I would expect the DA's office to be looking into.
You, your last big case there was against a guy named Billy Walters, who was a Las Vegas sports gambler who was convicted of this massive insider trading case. He was granted clemency by Donald Trump recently. Let me ask you a very hard question. You were out celebrating the night you got that verdict in the Walters case, and you got with FBI agents and I presume prosecutors as well for the success of the case. You got some terrible news. Tell me about that night and that call.
Yeah, this was a couple. This is maybe I think a week after his sentencing, or shortly after his sentencing, and we were going out for drinks to, thank each other and everybody for all the hard work that we had put into that case. And I got a call from my sister that my brother had died in a plane crash. And I will never, ever forget that phone call and where I was to hear that. My brother was a pilot and had a small plane out in San Francisco and was taking his two kids and his babysitter for a flight to go get some lunch somewhere, and his engine gave out and he went down, and he passed away and my niece passed away and the babysitter and my nephew survived, and they are thankfully physically okay today. But yeah, that was a jolt. That was more than a jolt. It was an incredibly difficult phone call and time period, in my life.
I'm sure having lost your dad when you did, you can provide something to your nephew in terms of understanding, you know?
Yeah, I try. It's a little bit, I'm the only male in my family to have lived past 42. So it's, you know, I think about that a lot. I think about my nephew. I think about my brother. My brother was incredibly politically engaged, and he was a history professor and I was a prosecutor, but where, you know, politics had nothing to do with my job in the U.S. Attorney's office. I didn't really pay that much attention to it. And now sort of, you know, through my impeachment world, impeachment life, our interests have collided, sadly, after he's passed away. But I think about him all the time.
You've said that your conversations with him about Trump shortly before he passed away were influential in your desire to get involved in the impeachment.
Yeah, no, they played a big role in me going down to D.C. I commuted down to Washington from New York. I have five children. It was very difficult on my family, my wife. But I felt, you know, I know my brother was becoming interested in, I mean, was incredibly knowledgeable about politics, and was interested in getting involved in government, and there was an opportunity that I felt not only I was interested in, but I thought that he would be, you know, appreciative of, and that I could do a little bit of the work that I know he wanted to do. So that was absolutely a motivating factor.
When you say that you're the only male who's lived past 42, what sense does that give you about the fragility of life and the preciousness of every day?
Well, as you would imagine, that year, you know, I was 41 when my brother passed away, and you know, that whole year I was 42, I was like panicked until I turned 43.
Yeah,
makes no sense, but I just felt like something.
I've now passed the age that my dad was when he died, and I lived with, for years and years and years, apprehension about that, about whether I would, you know, it's natural, I think, to think that way.
Yeah, I think it certainly was for me. And now, you know, as I contemplate next steps, you know, one of the things I think a lot about is what does truly matter. And it was hard to be away from my family, and I just made the, you know, made the decision that I'm not going to do that again. So when you talk about appreciating what you have and appreciating life, you know, there's the old adage, no one on their deathbed says, I wish I worked more. And so, you know, the opportunity and over the past year to sort of spend a lot of time with my family has been really, really helpful, really nice and really meaningful to me. And I think a lot about my brother, who, was such a family man and gave so much, you know, to his family and his kids. And, it's the fragility of life is real, and I've experienced it, sadly.
You talk about going down to DC. Is it true that you, that the whole thing began with running into Adam Schiff in the green room at NBC?
Yes, that's exactly what happened. It was June of 2018. We both were doing the 11 p.m. show with Brian Williams as the anchor. And I was on with a couple other people in the first block. And then Adam Schiff was going to be on. And Brian says, coming up next, we'll have Adam Schiff in studio. I said to Brian, always like, he's here. And I was a great admirer of Adam's. Yeah. At the time, I just think he's a incredibly smart, thoughtful, eloquent congressman and a former prosecutor as well. So I waited for him to finish. And as we were taking our makeup off in the green room, we were chatting about the Mueller investigation. I think that we trace this back to that was the day that Trump first floated the idea of pardoning himself. And so we were kind of chatting about that. And I said to him on the way out, I said, look, if there's ever an opportunity for me to come help you in any way, let me know. And he said, you know, there isn't now. But if we get the majority, there may be. And the House flipped in November. And a couple weeks later, I got a call from his team, Maher Batar, the fabulous general counsel, who's now for the House Intelligence Committee at the time, and went down to work for him in January of 19.
You worked for a year on this project. Tell me about your general reflections on that experience. And, you know, impeachment, I said this last night on TV, but you know, whether or not there is a conviction, and there never has been in the history of this country, because it's set up to be very, very difficult to achieve. The airing of these issues is an important thing for the country. In this case, that airing was made more difficult by the fact that Republicans in the Senate resisted witnesses and resisted the full presentation that you probably wanted to make. I mean, do you feel like you guys accomplished something important by doing it, or do you feel like you fell short of the goal and therefore you fail?
No, I do feel like for historical purposes, among others, it was very important that we did this. You know, when this issue came out in September of 2019, which was about 8 months into my time there, it had the groundswell of support from really the entire Democratic caucus in the House in a way that the Mueller investigation had not, and some of the other emolument stuff, some of the other issues that were raised related to Donald Trump's conduct in office just had not gained the same traction. But, you know, it's impeachment, as you pointed out at the beginning, is an inherently political thing, but we ran the investigation like I would have run any investigation in the U.S. Attorney's Office. I mean, we were in a pure fact-finding mission, and we were trying to get as many witnesses as we could, as fast as we could, to try to learn and get documents when we could. And you know, Donald Trump took unprecedented steps to obstruct the investigation and made it as difficult as possible on us. But I think at the end of the day, we were able to sort of put together an important narrative that showed how Donald Trump used his power, the most awesome power, which you are so familiar with from your time in President Obama's administration. And he used it just for his own personal gain to try to cheat in the election. And that's really important, I think, to call out, to push forward, to say that's not okay. And even if, because of the ultimate partisan nature of our government, you're not going to get 2/3 of the senators to convict. I think it's still important to lay down the marker and to say that, you know, you're impeached because you abused the power of your office, and that this going forward will be used as a precedent for impeachment. And people will look back to it and say, okay, this isn't what an abuse of power is, just like we look back to Clinton and Nixon and Andrew Johnson.
Yeah, and it was a prequel. You can really view the first impeachment in light of the second impeachment, because the impulse was the same, which is basically to subjugate all powers of the presidency to maintenance of the president in office.
And yeah, there's a direct through line. There's a direct through line. I mean, he tried to cheat in the election through extorting Ukraine to announce bogus investigations that would have been the equivalent of Hillary's emails in 2016. He failed in part because, you know, the young president of Ukraine stood up to him. I mean, it's sad that Ukraine, of all places, showed more democratic fortitude than Donald Trump did. But the president did, and I think in part because we caught him trying to do what he was doing, that he had to stop. And now, failing to cheat in the election, he tried to steal it. And, you know, you ask whether it was worth it, right? When you go back and you look at what some people, how some people justified their vote to say, look, let's let the voters decide in November. And I get that. I understand, you know, from their standpoint, it's a political animal anyway. It's not like, oh, this is a legal proceeding and then the election is a political thing. It's all political. I understand it. It wasn't that disheartening to me that they felt that, even though I could make the argument, did make the argument that impeachment is in the Constitution for a reason, in addition to elections. But then for him to try to steal and overthrow the voters' will in November, you know, ratchets up the conduct to a whole nother level.
I can't let you go without asking you, given your commitment to public service, do you see yourself in public service again?
I do. I really hope to. It's hard to figure out how or where, but I would love nothing more.
Would you run for office?
You know, it's not a priority of mine right now. Not a focus of what I want to do. I'm you know, would love to join the Biden administration in some capacity if there was an opportunity for me to do so. I feel like my background as a lawyer is what really drives me, not as a politician. And frankly, being in D.C. for a year does not make me want to be a politician anymore than it did before. But you know, the advantage and the appeal of being in office is that, you know, you write the laws and you can actually have the most impact, the most material change of anything is through laws and that are enacted more than interpreting laws or enforcing laws. So there is that appeal. But, you know, politics is a tough game right now, and the partisanship is really unfortunate.
Well, I have a strong sense that we have not heard the last from you in any way, and I'm grateful for it. I'm grateful for your service and for this time with you. Dan Goldman, great to be with you.
It's really been a pleasure, David. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, brought to you by the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio. The executive producer of the show is Emily Stanitz. The show is also produced by Miriam Annenberg, Jeff Fox, Hannah McDonald, and Allison Siegel. And special thanks to our partners at CNN, including Courtney Coop, Ashley Lusk, and Megan Marcus. For more programming from the IOP, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.